This is a session on war tax resistance and war tax refusal. There are many different kinds of tax resistance. This session is specifically on war tax resistance because of many people's firm belief in the immorality of modern war and of taxes levied to support that war. And there are also many different reasons to be a war tax resister or to resist paying taxes because of war. Some people resist simply because they believe it to be a very rational thing to do. Some are humanists that simply cannot pay for others, think it's inhumane to pay for something that kills, and believe that war will only stop when we cease to pay for it. Others are nuclear pacifists, meaning that they're not necessarily opposed to all war, at least they weren't up until the time that nuclear war became a possibility, and now a probability, but who now believe that war is immoral because of nuclear armaments, and that there never can be another justifiable war. Some people are anarchists. In other words, they're of the opinion that the government can obviously not handle what they've been given, so the idea is not to pay taxes at all and not to give them any support. Some people believe that tax resistance is a very un-American thing to do. For other people, it gets at the very roots of patriotism, and it is a very American thing to do for them. And it's also a stance that more and more Christians today are taking precisely because they believe it to be a faith issue. So there are many ways to get at this very controversial issue, and I think because we live in a Christian community here at Holden, I'd like to get into some discussions a little later on about war taxes and our faith and the relationship between those two. We certainly won't do all of it tonight. I only have an hour. So I hope you're comfortable with ending the session on a semicolon and continuing to talk about it as many sessions at Holden go. I think I might be frustrated because I've done this before in two sessions, the first session being an hour just on what the Bible has to say about taxes, and the second hour talking more about tax resistance in the United States today. So I'll try to do a little bit of both. And I'll try to talk for maybe a half hour and cut it off and then open it up for discussion so we have time to talk. Another thing to know tonight, I am starting with the assumption that the Bible does have lots to say about opposition to violence, and it advocates other ways of dealing with our enemies both on a personal and corporate level. I'm making this assumption clear that we as Christians need to be saying no to the arms race, not because we're all in this room agreed on that, not because there isn't more to say on that subject, but because tonight I'd like to sort of focus in on this particular issue of our own personal connection to war through our own personal tax dollars. And if we want to talk about whether or not we should be opposing the arms race, I think there is time to do that. It's a good subject to talk about. Maybe we can talk to Darius, our village philosopher, and see if there is time to talk about that later this week, if that's where the group wants to go. But I'd like to stick on the issue of tax resistance tonight because I think that kind of resistance to war is becoming more and more publicized. It's becoming more and more important. As John said in his announcement, at least at first setting, he mentioned that if you are in the Seattle area, you're probably already aware of the idea of tax resistance through the witness of Archbishop Hunthausen, the Catholic Archbishop of Seattle, who has suggested that a large number of people of this state undertake a tax revolt and in opposition to the buildup of nuclear armaments. And most recently, he has decided himself to withhold 50% of his personal tax dollars this year. But anyway, I wanted to tell you that I'm starting with the assumption that we as Christians need to be opposing the arms race in some way. And if it's not out of a New Testament love for our enemies, at least for the sake of our own children. I'd like to take a brief look at what the Bible has to say about taxes, but I think first it's important to know about taxes in our own country. And by the way, war tax resistance does have very deep roots in this country. In fact, war tax resistance predates the Constitution. Mostly this kind of resistance, though, was only found early on, was only found through the witness of the historic peace churches, the Quakers, the Mennonites, and the Church of the Brethren. But there were tax resistors in colonial America, Revolutionary War, Civil War, all the way up, but never in large numbers until World War II. I think partly this is because income tax was such a small percentage of where the government got its money. I think right before World War II, there was something like 3% of the population paying income tax. And then after the World War II, it jumped way up. But it's important to note that the federal income tax in this country was started as a direct result of war. And income tax has been the main financial source of war and war preparation. So there really is, I think it's important to understand that there is an important connection between our paying taxes and the war effort and war preparation. If you look at graphs any time of the level of income tax through the history of this country, it's really interesting to note that you can see a direct relationship between war efforts and the level of tax that we pay. It'd be interesting sometime to have a whole session just on the budget and war. I think I'll try to do that sometime, because you could spend a whole hour just talking about how we've paid for war in the past and the consequences of that. But today, tax figures continue to change along with new approvals of budgets. So I'll try to give you the latest information that I have. I hope you can all see this board. What I have up here is the pie for fiscal year 1982 federal funds. And trying to figure out percentages of defense spending is a little bit tricky, and I'll try to explain why. You might have seen figures that show the percentage of defense spending being around 25 or 26% of the budget. It's a little bit confusing because there's something called the unified budget. The federal government gets its money mostly through income tax, but it also gets money through trust funds, which are collected by a separate process in income tax. The largest trust fund being, of course, Social Security. There's an airline trust fund. There's a highway trust fund. There's some other smaller ones.
Does that include the railroad retirement fund and different things like that?
I'm not sure. Does anyone know if that's a trust fund?
I think railroad retirement is, yeah.
That would be something similar. When they figure out, when the government publishes figures on defense spending, a lot of times they'll include the trust funds in with the federal funds and call it the unified budget, which really does tend to make defense spending look smaller and social spending bigger. But from the taxpayer's point of view, it's a little bit deceiving. Because from these figures, which does not include the trust funds, which are separate funds, they don't come from our tax dollars, and they're always used for what they were raised for. So they're never a part of the military, and they're not part of what we pay to the government. From the taxpayer's viewpoint, this is a more accurate way to display military spending. And because of the fact that the government does not publish this, you have to kind of pull it out of their records. You get all sorts of different figures, and I've come across three recent figures, and I took the most conservative of the three. This is the lowest amount. 37% for current, the left-hand side of this is all military. 37% of our tax dollar goes to current military expenditures. Now, that includes not only the Defense Department, but some defense-related expenditures go through the Department of Energy for nuclear weapons and whatnot. 20% for past wars, interest on past wars, and 5% for veterans' benefits. And also, I think that's what, 56%? Is that right? 57%? For total military expenditures out of our tax dollars. On the other side, human resources, 24%, physical resources, 10%, and general government, 10%. But those are the latest figures, and I'm sure that will go up next year, as it's been rising every year for a long time. These figures I have down here are a little bit dated, but I thought they were kind of interesting because it split it up a little bit. This is President Carter, before he went out of office, had his 1982 proposed budget, which I have down here, and it's all split up into research and development, operations, weapon purchase, other, and then past wars. A total of $259,500,000,000. And that is President Carter's proposed 1982 budget, and President Reagan's was considerably higher than that. I think it's around 280, or 284, if I'm not mistaken. That means approximately, today, $1,344 per person per year that's going to defense spending. So you have to figure out if you're an average person or not, but that's how much we're all paying for defense spending, is $1,300 and $1,344 per person per year.
And children.
That's for everyone in the country.
Let me
read what they say. This total means that the average person in the United States will pay $1,344. So I don't know who's an average person, but I assume they just took the population, or I don't know if they took the number of tax-paying individuals. I'm not sure.
Except in 1978, the figure was $455 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And I kind of think that that's probably man, woman, and child.
Mm-hmm. That's still up there.
Just to give you an idea of what kind of money we're talking about, by diverting approximately 5% of this 1982 proposed military budget, again, this is Carter's, not Reagan's, we could achieve eradication of protein malnutrition in children, food production to prevent famine, primary school for all children, create an international disaster relief force, achieve literacy for all adults, eradicate malaria, prevent anemia, and prevent vitamin A deficiency blindness. All of this could be done throughout the world with just 5% of the proposed 1982 U.S. military costs. So overkill from bombs is not really the only kind of overkill that you get by paying war taxes. I think that this brings home a point that we're all connected to the arms race. Many of us in the Lutheran Church or in other denominations probably pay up to 3 to 4 times as much through the federal income tax as we do for any church-related activities. And I don't know if that brings it home in a little different way. I think this also points out the drastic change in warfare over the last century. As long as it's necessary to have huge armies to wage wars, then if you were opposed to killing, if you thought it was immoral, then an appropriate response or appropriate witness might have been conscientious objection if you were a man. In other words, you would just object to the government using your own person to kill. But now, when it becomes possible through automated warfare to kill with manless missiles, with ICBMs, with few people, minimal personnel, then the witness of holding your economic support becomes all the more important for the Christian. And I think this is especially true for us men who are above draft age. It was an interesting day when I kind of figured out, hey, I'm still implicated in this arms race, in this war effort, even though I'm no longer of draft age. I think that's true for senior citizens, and true for women. All of us pay taxes, and we're all connected. Conscientious objection usually only applied to of age men who wanted to exercise their conscience, but we are all directly connected to war because warfare today demands less of our person than it does of our pocketbook. So I think if we're worried about war, if we're concerned about war, we have to be worried about taxes, and that's one of the points I want to make tonight. I'd like to just briefly look at least one passage in the Bible, and I want to be careful because it's easy to come off like I'm proof texting. I don't want to do that, but I do want to take a look at least one text that I think has been used on the other side as a proof text, saying that taxes, the refusal of war taxes is immoral or against the Bible. But we would do well tonight to avoid two extremes, neither of which I think hold up in Scripture. One is the extreme that says the Bible commands us to pay our taxes all the time in every situation. I think one of the biggest barriers for us to overcome in considering war tax refusal is the almost universal assumption that the Bible speaks very clearly with one voice on the payment of taxes, and that we should in all situations at all times pay our taxes. I don't think there's that kind of absolutist view in the Bible. It doesn't say that we should pay our taxes at all times. I think at the same time we have to avoid the other extreme. The anarchist position I don't think holds up in the Bible either, that we should try to avoid at all costs paying taxes. There are just too many biblical guidelines that point to God creating the powers and principalities and our need as Christians to be servants of the common good. So I think there is biblical support for the payment of taxes, but the question tonight is war taxes. And it's important to keep the context and reference to the biblical message and also the context in reference to the tax situation of that day. And I'd just like to start out by reading a few paragraphs from Dale Brown, who's written an article, The Bible on Tax Resistance, gives us a little bit of a background on what the tax situation was at the time of Jesus. Under Herod the Great, the tax burden had become unbearable. Though first approving the rebuilding of the temple, the Jewish people reached the point of resistance to a luxurious court and a building program out of proportion to the national wealth. There was a land tax, a poll tax, personal property taxes, export and import customs on salt, and numerous items. The burden was intensified by the fact that there were two complete systems of taxation. In addition to the tribute due to foreign rulers, there is an annual half-shekel payment to the temple. It's estimated that the total taxation at the time of Jesus, civil and religious, totaled from 30 to 40% of the total income. It's not surprising, then, that the scribes and Pharisees spoke of tax collectors and sinners in the same breath. The Jews of Palestine felt free from obligations to pay the tribute. Payment was often regarded as an acknowledgement of Caesar as Lord. Since the form of idolatry most repugnant to the Jews was emperor worship, his image was detested. How do the gospel writers place Jesus in this context? In answer to the query about his eating and drinking with tax collectors, Jesus neither approved what they were doing nor rejected them as persons. Instead, he affirmed that he had come to call sinners to repentance. Since some biblical scholars find evidence that as many as half of the special 12 chosen by Jesus were from the extremist or zealot party, it is maintained that Jesus identified with many of their sentiments concerning the righteousness and justice of the coming kingdom. At the same time, he could not identify with their deep hatred and violent plans. We do not possess certain evidence that Jesus was or was not an active teacher of tax resistance. If he was, it is fairly certain that he was a different kind of tax resister than his zealot associates. This broader context should be kept in mind as we examine any passages appropriated as proof texts for this issue. I'd like to look at just one of those texts tonight because of time. If we could, those who have Bibles, I don't know how many do, could you turn to Matthew 22, 15 to 22. Matthew 22, 15 to 22. Barb, could you read that for us?
Sure. Then the Pharisees went and took counsel how to entangle him in his talk. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true, and teach the way of God truthfully, and care for no man, for you do not regard the position of men. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the money for the tax. And they brought him a coin. And Jesus said to them, Whose likeness and inscription is this? They said, Caesar's. Then he said to them, Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away.
Okay. Two antagonistic parties. As you know, the Pharisees and the Herodians were usually at each other's throats, but in this case, they were kind of colluding against Jesus to entrap him. It was it was obviously a no-win situation for Jesus. Either way, he would have indicted himself. If he would have said, yes, I pay the taxes, he would have been in trouble with the people. If he would have said no, he would have been in trouble with the officials. But it's a trap set to try to indict him, to commit himself to one side or the other. The answer is interesting, I think. He calls for a coin, and what most people would have pulled out of their pocket at that time would have been a Tyrian shekel, which is the common currency at that time in Palestine. But what he did pull out was a denarius, and I think it says it down there at the bottom of the, at least my RSV says, has a little letter that says a Greek denarius, which on the one side had an image of Caesar, and you remember for Jews at that time, images were very offensive. On the other side, or at the bottom, it had an inscription at the bottom that claimed the divinity of Caesar. Most Palestinian Jews would not lay their hands on that kind of coin. And so the fact that these people had a denarii or some denarii in their pocket, the fact that they had money of their oppressor in their pocket, which was manufactured way on the other side of the Mediterranean, seemed to indicate that they already closely aligned with Caesar, or they were of the government of Caesar, or closely associated with that government. And you should again remember the mindset of the Jew. They would have had an immediate reaction, tax collector and sinner in the same breath, the danger of idolatry to one who claimed to be divine. Some scholars go so far as to say that what Jesus was really saying was, look, you've already aligned yourself, or you've obviously chosen who you serve, so give to your Lord and God what your Lord and God deserves. Render to Yahweh what belongs to Yahweh. But either way, there's no absolute conclusion as to what to do. It's sort of thrown back onto us. We have to choose what is faithful and what is unfaithful, or we have to decide what allegiance means. But in any rate, it can't be used as a simple proof text to say, yes, you should pay your taxes at all times. It's not a story about the payment of taxes for all time and all history. It's a particular situation. Again, it's not a war tax. There was not a war tax in that day. But I think what this story does for us is that it puts the things that are God's and the things that are Caesar's into a little bit of tension. And I think that's hard for us as Americans sometimes. We don't often see that. So much of our problem has been thinking that the things that are God's are the spiritual things, or the things up there, and the things that are Caesar's are down here. And Jesus' answer, I think, sort of points to us that sometimes there are demands that overlap, or sometimes there are demands that conflict with Caesar's demands, and we have to face those. So I think it's clear from this passage, and there are some others that we could examine, but maybe we could do that at a later time if people would like to do that. Romans 13 comes to mind right away, that it has often been used as a proof text against any kind of tax resistance. But the question always seems to be thrown back onto us, and I don't think as Christians we can escape that duty to look at the tensions between the claims of God and the claims of Caesar. I think it's been true throughout Christianity that there could be times, could be situations where faithfulness might lead us to civil disobedience. And I think we can ask now whether the arms race is one of those points in history where faithfulness might lead us in that direction. But as Christians, we're not first and foremost about resisting the U.S. government or resisting paying taxes, but perhaps resisting as a response to a call to be peacemakers. And that's what many people are saying today, is that paying taxes for war is disobeying Jesus' call to love our enemies, to do good to those who hate us, to bless those who persecute us. I'll just read another short couple paragraphs from John Howard Yoder in an article he wrote a few years ago, Why I Don't Pay All of My Income Tax. He says, one question remains which both the Internal Revenue Service inspector and Christians have asked already. Does not the New Testament instruct us to pay our taxes? Certainly it does, and I want to pay my taxes and do pay them willingly as far as the functions of the United States government resemble what Jesus and Paul and Peter were talking about. The lesson of the entire New Testament is that Christians should be subject to political authority, because in the providence of God, the function of these authorities is to maintain peace. This is what I, in accordance with the instructions of the New Testament, am asking the American government to do. I am, in fact, even willing to pay for a certain amount of waste and fraud and incompetence. But the one thing I'm not prepared to support voluntarily is something which Jesus and Paul did not have in mind, because it did not exist in the time of the New Testament. The government of Rome was not spending more than half of its resources on preparations to destroy the rest of the world. The authority which Jesus and Paul recognized was in that entire age much more comparable to the police function than to the modern economy for international war. It is not often noticed that Romans 13 provides textual grounds for questioning any government on its propriety of the requirements it makes of its citizens. Romans 13:7 says specifically, not that we are to render to government what it asks for, but that we are to give to each what is due, tax to whom tax is due, toll to whom toll, worship to whom worship. There is no easy discharge from the duty to test which of the demands are Caesar's and really the things that are Caesar's and which are not his due. It is not my purpose to agitate for others to follow my example. At the same time, I am asking whether others have found more appropriate ways to render a worthwhile testimony against their nation's trust in the sword. I guess my main point tonight is not to come across and say that if one wants to be a responsible Christian, one should do tax resistance. I don't think that's the point at all. But I'm saying that paying taxes for us should be a faith issue. It was a faith issue in the Bible. It's nothing new. So every time that we sign our name at the bottom of the tax form, I think we should think about what we're doing in relation to our calling as peacemakers, because I think that if we're concerned about war, we should be concerned about taxes today. I won't go into all of the logistical details of being a tax resister, because I don't think the how-to is the most important thing, but I think we can get into a discussion. I might want to point out that not all forms of tax resistance are illegal. There are some legal methods. You could simply write your congressman, and many people do, about their views on taxes for war. And by the way, there is a bill in Congress right now which hasn't done very well, but it's called the World Peace Tax Fund Bill, which is an effort to make war tax resistance legal. And if this bill were passed, what would happen is on your tax form there would be a little box that you could check off. And it would say, I am morally opposed to war and do not want any of my funds to go to war. And therefore, if you check that box, your funds would sort of do alternative service, like conscientious objectors do right now. So you wouldn't be paying any less taxes, but you would be assured that your money would only go toward peaceful purposes. And there'd be a special fund set up for that by a board of directors or whatever. But I think that's a real interesting attempt to make something that's now illegal, something now that many people are doing anyway, a legal means of representing your protest. So you could support the World Peace Tax Fund Bill. You could write a letter of protest along with your tax form and just send it in. It's perfectly legal, but it lets the IRS at least know that you are opposed to this. You could write letters send Xerox copies to your congresspeople and to your church leaders. You could support a tax resister. There are several in the village right now. You could choose to live under a taxable income, which many people do to avoid paying taxes for war. They just choose to. I think it's hard to do right now. I was a VISTA volunteer last year in Minneapolis, and I made more than the taxable amount. So it's very difficult to do, but I think it's a worthy method of protest. There are some illegal methods. One is withholding your telephone tax, and not many people know that the U.S. tax on your telephone is a war tax. It was levied to be a war tax, reduced, and then rose very sharply during the Vietnam War and has been slowly declining, but it is still going. It was promised that that tax would be taken off the phone. It has not been taken off. It's actually been extended. Yeah.
Currently being used to pay off the Vietnam Yeah, I imagine
war.
That would be true.
And that when that war supposedly paid off.
It was supposed to end this year, and it has not. It has been extended. That's the latest I've heard. So
it's been decreasing.
It's been decreasing. So it is very small. And that's because other people have registered that protest. During the Vietnam years, there were thousands and thousands of people that refused to pay their telephone tax. And there is no record of anyone being prosecuted for that. I know a number of people that have refused to pay that portion. And it is a strong witness because you are objecting to and you are refusing to pay to that which you object. In other words, it's not a mixed tax where part of it goes for good purposes and part of it goes to war. All of it goes to war. So it's a stronger witness than the income tax. But again, as you said, it's a very small amount right now. And the other way that many people now are being tax resistors is holding a percentage of your income tax from the IRS. And there are many, many ways to do this, even if your taxes withheld from you. People withhold many different percentages, 10%, 38%, symbolic amount, 50%. Some people don't pay any of their taxes because they feel that all of it will go to war anyway. But the idea is not to keep any of this money, but to rechannel it into peaceful purposes, either to a World Hunger Appeal or some peace group or some local community group that is working for peace or strengthening the country. I think I'd like to open it up right now. I've gone about half an hour and I can answer questions. I'd like to just hear some responses on what people think of the idea of tax resistance as a response to the arms race. I'd like to know what people think about Reverend Hunthausen, if you're from the Seattle area or the Northwest, what you think about that kind of witness. Also, John mentioned this, that the announcement there is right now, a call to tax resistance for Lutherans. There's a copy of this in the bookstore itself for a nickel. It says, we will not qualify our condemnation. There is no moral justification for the existence of nuclear weapons. They are an abomination in the sight of God. In return for security from our enemies that is in reality an obscene terror, we willfully offer our sacrifice of our tax dollars to a deadly idol. God forgive us, we have done so willingly. Sisters and brothers, we call upon you to pray with us for a peaceful world. We call upon you to join us in tax resistance as Christian witness against nuclear weapons. We call upon you to affirm with passionate action that Jesus Christ is Lord. Lutheran Peace Fellowship is putting this out and has an alternative fund already that you can channel your funds into. I guess I'd like to open up and see what people's reactions are.
There's another safe way of doing it, or legal way of doing it, but the result is unknown at this time. Several people had paid all their taxes and then filed an amended return saying that they want 37% back, or whatever percent you want to use back. There's another way of protesting and making them.
In many instances, that money has been sent back, and then the IRS has turned around and asked for it back. That then it's illegal. But they have sent it back.
I think people need to know that when you don't pay your telephone tax, the telephone company will not shut off your telephone. Yeah. They have nothing whatsoever to do with that. They just agreed to be the receptacle for collecting the tax, and so you don't have to be afraid that you'll be without a telephone. And they finally write back and say, you don't have to keep writing every time why you're not paying, we know.
They
just keep adding it onto your bill, but you just keep not paying it, and you start every month just writing a letter and saying why you're not paying it, and the nice companies or the nice computer that gets it writes back. Yeah, you don't have to tell us every time.
I don't know if you have a copy in the village anywhere of the position paper that was presented at the ALC convention this past, I think, February or whenever that was. It's really pleasing to find out that the Lutheran Church, American Lutheran Church anyway, which has not traditionally been a peace church, has taken a stand on the issue of nuclear warfare and has decided that they can support people protesting that kind of war, even though they can't support people necessarily who protest all kinds of wars. But the interesting phrase in Yoder's article there, which is, I mean, it's a very curious question for me, facing a government that really seems to be full of madmen sometimes, juggling nuclear arms around like they were toys, and making a statement in some kind of a powerful statement to a government that this is crazy. I mean, that it's absolutely crazy, and that the American Lutheran Church, I mean, I think that's quite brave. I think that's a real powerful statement for a church like that to make, where they have not supported conscientious objectors, I don't believe, in past wars. And people have had a lot of difficulty getting that church and other non-peace churches to make some kind of a statement to the government. But as far as not being able to support the anarchist view, it's very difficult sometimes to feel like one shouldn't be an anarchist in the face of crazy people. I mean, not everybody in the government is crazy, but when we push things, particularly, I guess, the space shuttle, I guess that's where it hit me most. Mm-hmm. When I began to realize what they were talking about when the space shuttle goes up. Every time it goes up, they talk about the packages that they're going to carry. And they talk about being able to extend that arm out into space and pluck things from space and put them back into the space shuttle and pick things up and put them out into space. And when you realize what it is they're talking about putting into space and taking out of space, it's like machines up there juggling nuclear warheads over us. And at some point or other, there's got to be a way to say to the government, enough craziness, enough madness, it's over our heads. I mean, it's bad enough that we have nuclear reactors around our major cities.
What gave you the idea that that's what that arm is for?
If you listened to the interviews with the, especially the last two pilots of the space shuttle, when they, mostly the newscasters have talked about the space shuttle in terms of business, possibilities for transport of business, of equipment, things like that. But those two pilots were the first I ever heard talk very specifically about the military uses of this machine. And when you think about the fact of how long it takes to get that shuttle up in the air, how long it takes to get it back down, a Concorde or an SST can do it much faster than a space shuttle can do it and cover the same distance. That the purpose of that machine, as nearly as I can figure, has very little to do with capitalistic business of this country or trade with other countries. It has much more to do, I think, with us flexing our muscles and telling the rest of the world that now we can not only send jets to your country, but we can have something that's going around in the ionosphere carrying things that will throw at you if you're not careful. And it was the first time that I heard those military people say it. And when they said it, it all of a sudden occurred to me that this thing, I mean, why should we be doing this? I mean, it's amazing and it's beautiful to watch it. And all of the imagery that they use for the space shuttle, they're comparing it to the first flights of human beings with the Wright brother. And they're talking about the beauty of it. And when you think about the purpose of it and what it can accomplish, it seems to me that there's really only one purpose for it, and that's to go up and get Soviet missiles, Soviet warheads, and pluck them out of the sky and put our own there to threaten them.
The question is, in the face of that, how does one register a protest?
Yeah.
And should the church be supporting people who are tax resistors or who are fence climbers? It's somewhat the same issue. It's not really, but I'm not talking about asking people to do this, but should the church be supportive of people? Maybe there's a question that can be asked.
That was a problem in our church because we're in ALC and the conference is passing a petition through all the congregations. We've got dissension now in our congregation. Some of the congregational people, this is not a job for the church.
What do people think?
Well, I just like to say that that's probably the major thing that I've heard from church people, especially Lutheran church people, that politics and church don't mix. But I think that we have to turn our thinking around and see that everything we do is political in some way. In last night, John Sherman was talking about justice. In that way, however we respond to the world in the area of justice, whether it's whether we're helping justice or hindering justice, we're political, and we can't separate ourselves from being political, I don't think.
Is there any way to be neutral on this issue? There was a hand back there.
Well, I'm in no hurry, but do you suppose it's safe to say a few words for the other side?
Sure.
I begin to wonder.
Be disappointed if it
the wording is a little more sophisticated, but I've heard the sense of it before, 30, 40 years ago. And World War II was just not quite started yet. And it was a popular thing for kids, of which I was then one, about 20, something like that, 22. Well, a magazine article hit just a few months before the war really cranked up. And the title was, "I Think I'll Sit This One Out." And the I, kids like myself, sounded pretty good. But then Germany went into Poland just about a month after that article. And pretty soon it's Czechoslovakia, then Austria, and all of a sudden the Japs would bomb Pearl Harbor, and I find myself headed for the Navy. And it didn't look the whole thing, but believe me, I was going to sit it out until that darn draft notice turned out. So what we hear tonight, don't think of it as brand new, because it's happened before. If we had been successful in sitting it out last time around, we wouldn't be here tonight talking about it now.
It may be new, but it's totally, it may not be all that new, but it is totally different just by the mere existence of nuclear weapons, which have the power to
destroy. Let's don't go into that, because it really isn't.
True.
In my Bible, the last book makes it pretty clear that if you're worried about war, you haven't seen anything yet. You just haven't seen anything.
Excuse me, but nowhere in the Bible do I find anywhere where we are supposed to just sit on our butts and watch the world go to pot.
Hold it.
So,
it's my turn.
Okay.
I'm almost finished. It's my turn. We will not hear determine and then settle any matter in regard to what to do. It will be set of force, however. Believe it. When they start after us, we'll fight back. We did last time, we'll do it again. And I suppose, as before, we will find ourselves woefully unprepared for it. But this time, apparently not quite so unprepared as we were before. We then had 3,000 miles of ocean to give us time. That's gone. But forget all that. Regardless of what happens war-wise, face up to it, friends, that if we persist in this matter of entering the political arena through the avenue of withholding taxes, and believe me, in Oregon, it'll be just 6 months until we're paying taxes on our churches. Because in order to enter that political arena, you gotta pay your dues. And those dues are taxes. And property taxes on our establishment would really sink us in regard to our current income. It would just kill us.
Does anyone want to respond to that?
Well, not a response, perhaps support, sort of. I know we all realize that defense spending has gone, and let me emphasize the word defense rather than war, has gone quite out of proportions. And I think the proposals that have been made here and the thoughts that have been brought about are quite idealistic, but probably quite out of touch with realism. The gentleman has been on one side, and I was on the other side in the last conflict.
I had a hunch.
And I came to realize that this was finally was the country where one had to come to live as one's beliefs. Because as he said, if the other side, which happened to be my side at the time, would have won, none of us would be sitting here and discussing the things really. No way. And I like your pie that you have on the board there. But you know, this pie can be presented in all kinds of shapes and forms. Mm-hmm. I've seen it done where the social part got way out of proportion. So what I'm saying is, yes, I agree. We should all work for a peaceful solution of our problems, but never on a unilateral basis, because that cannot be done. It has to be done through negotiation, through talking, not through withholding, but through putting your effort to where it will do the most good and getting the people into Washington who are capable of bringing about a peaceful solution to things.
One way of looking at withholding taxes is as a way of raising consciousness with the public, with the people in Washington, that we want some talk on nuclear weapons and that we would like to see some negotiation, not unilateral maybe, bilateral, definitely. And one way, if you can't get people's attention any other way, perhaps you have to resort to something like withholding taxes. Now, in going back to pre-nuclear age, World War II, obviously, I mean, the problem of the evil, and when we faced Nazi Germany, and we said that if we had not stood up to Nazi Germany, we would not be here, I believe you're right. I think our problem is in who is or what is our evil today. Is it the Soviet Union, or is it the existence of nuclear weapons? And I'd say that it's nuclear weapons.
You can't separate the two.
Well, then you can't separate the U.S. and nuclear weapons either, right?
Correct.
Okay, so what we need to do is work on the evil of the nuclear weapon. And perhaps one way to do that is by withholding tax.
I'm sure we all agreed on the evil of nuclear weapons.
Dan,
you
had the same question.
Well, one, sometimes it helps to separate an idea or move from an idea to a person. And I would just say that I am a vortex resistor, Carmen Knight. It's a matter that doesn't take a lot of logical arguing, but it's a matter of deep conscience, I think. The other thing is that I understand very deeply my people of an older generation that were deeply involved in the Second World War. And it's very hard to see that with the atomic age, we're in a whole new reality. We are not in the same world whatsoever. And at that point, to say that resistance is unrealistic is very hard for me to hear. The pathway that we are on is extremely unrealistic, as I see it. Secondly, faithfulness to Jesus Christ does not ask, first of all, for the perfect results, but it's simply a matter of obedience and even a readiness for that to be called naive, unrealistic. Many people through the ages have been seen that way. But I think it's part of the Holden experience to get in touch with what maybe the forum will be tonight. Is there a certain craziness as far as the standards of the world are concerned? Is that maybe where the hope of the world lies? But just those are some random thoughts on the
Since we do live in a Christian community, I'd like for it to continue on the faith aspect, because I think it's important for us to think about these things as a Christian, and how does the payment of war taxes, or how do nuclear weapons relate to our faith?
I'm not sure if this is really what he says, but it bothers me when he says, well, you know, if you start doing this, we're going to have to start paying taxes to the church. Somehow, that makes me feel the church is kind of the kept woman of the state, and that bothers the daylights out of me. That we would be willing to keep our mouths shut, you know, for the sake of, you know, maybe we ought to start paying taxes for our churches, period, for our local fire protection and all that stuff.
There are many people today that are proposing that.
I think it's a matter of time, and we will be.
Our pastor says he wishes we would be paying taxes.
Hand over here.
Three quick points. Number one, I do agree with that last one. I do think it could be well the argument that the most effective stimulus to return the churches in this country toward the New Testament ideal would be to lose the tax exemption. Point number two, the distinction between nuclear war and other kinds of war, I guess I see as more emotional than rational. As a young infantry officer in the Second World War, one of my jobs was to teach bayonet to other young infantrymen, and that's as horrible a way to face death, and plus our use of white phosphorus, particularly effective in the Pacific theater, which is inhumane at a much more personal level than, so I guess I think the peace churches in their traditional opposition really are providing a kind of leadership to support. Third point, I learned a lot during the Vietnam conflict from a young faculty colleague who came in, I was going into college, and he came in to simply let me know. He said, I think somebody at the college ought to know that my wife and I are withholding a certain portion of our income tax as an expression of our disapproval of our involvement in the Vietnam War. I've informed IRS that we are putting this in a special account. See, I think it's important to distinguish this, the withholding of tax from simple tax evasion. There are members of the mafia who really are in the same position of the IRS as somebody who simply doesn't pay their full income tax. And I think the tradition of civil disobedience, which in effect says, I'm willing to pay the price, but I want it to be an object lesson. I'm standing for principle. So I think that the mechanism, and you said that logistics were not important, but I think there are some important matters of principle in terms of the way you do it, which might be very important.
It's not only resisting, but affirming life as well. Mary?
Well, I just want to add that John and I are tax resistors too, and we do so basically because of an idolatry issue, and that to me is a faith issue for the reason we are tax resistors. The Bible, the New Testament, speaks more about idolatry than any other thing, more than sin, grace, heaven, hell, anything. The idolatry issue is the big thing, and I always thought because I didn't have a gold Buddha in our living room or something that I was free from that. And I just am realizing more and more that to trust in nuclear weapons or in military defense for our security is idolatry. And I think it's Isaiah that talks about, God says, I am not pleased with your horses and with your armies. And I just feel like God is saying that to us, that God is not pleased with where we're putting our trust. And the only way I can say to my government, I don't like this. My trust is someplace else. Is to be a tax resister, and that is naive. It is unrealistic. It's not rational. It's goofy. We are peculiar people, but I think that's what we're called to be. And the other thing I want to say is that it cannot be a fad or a one-shot thing. It's a lifetime hassle, and anybody that wants to attempt it should know that they're going to be constantly having to go down and justify and maybe have their property sold. It is a risk, and it's not an easy thing to do, like not paying your phone tax when nobody even cares about that. But I just want to say
that. Maybe I didn't make that very clear. I don't see tax resistance as a single issue. It's part of my larger, deeper commitment to peace work, but I really, after a while, found it very hard to work for peace while I was funneling my personal tax dollars toward the war effort, and it just came down to the fact that I can't be opposed to killing but pay for someone else to do it. So I think that's very important, that tax resistance is a first step toward a life of working for peace. There is one here, and then Charles.
Thank you. I just want to say that I'm a tax resister because I've seen what it is that we're defending around the globe, and I've seen what it does to people, and I think in a lot of cases it's demonic. I feel like as a Christian, there's no way I can continue to support that. And I guess I believe when I talk about the coming of the kingdom of God, that that's going to mean that America is no longer number one. And I support that too. That's part of my confession and looking toward the kingdom.
I think it's very interesting for people who were able to see it, the PBS series on Oppenheimer that was done very recently, and the man who headed the whole project to split the atom for the United States so that we could defeat an evil that everyone agreed was an evil. And interesting that the BBC had to produce this series to show us something about our history. Interesting that it studied a man who apparently was a very arrogant human being who felt that in his hands he had the power to make some changes about how the world ran, and when he finally faced up to the fact of what he had done, his terror was probably more than anybody could ever imagine. And in the face of that terror, the man who created it was awed and called himself the destroyer of worlds, and called himself death. And if he must do that, then we who put our money toward making more and more and more must call ourselves something similar.
I think we should end. Time for Vespers. I want to keep this talk going about the connections between us and war. And also, a couple times we've talked a little bit about oddness, and maybe we could continue that at 9 o'clock at the forum. But thank you for coming. And if you didn't get out what you wanted to get out, maybe there can be another time to continue this discussion. There are some books in the bookstore, so ask Mary or feel free to ask me about more on tax resistance. Thank you.